when you burn off mercury, it becomes a vapor and you could inhale it just like any other gas or dust.
Concerns over mercury poisoning in Nome gold miners. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, August 22nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Fairbanks borough officials propose a gas distribution network.
I would argue that there's a public need and there would be a huge public benefit from dollars going into a distribution system.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
How do you get men to wear a life jacket when the fact is that 90% of those who die in boating accidents in Alaska are men? Well, most men won't listen to this message, but they might listen to you. So have them pledge to wear a life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. That's pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back home. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Mercury testing in gold miners in Nome is going to take place next week. The Alaska Department of Health and Social Services will conduct the voluntary screenings that were prompted from concerns that miners in Nome may be exposed to harmful levels of mercury fumes. KNOM's Lorelei Kanin has the story.
The gold being dredged from the seafloor just offshore of Nome is often attached to mercury that was used during the gold rush in the late 1800s and early 1900s. Mercury was often used during the gold rush to extract gold.
Because mercury forms an amalgam with gold and other metals, and it's a great way to bind it.
Ali Hamade is an environmental public health program manager and will be in Nome next week with a few colleagues to conduct the testing. He says the mercury used more than 100 years ago is binding to gold on the seafloor. He says the Department of Health and Social Services have received anecdotal accounts that some miners may be heating the gold to drive off the mercury.
And when you burn off mercury, it becomes a vapor and you could inhale it just like any other gas or dust. And if we find that some miners are exposed to levels that could be harmful to their health, we'll follow up with them, let them know what they need to do to prevent that. And if we don't see that they're exposed, we'll also let them know. And that's even better.
Hamade says the effects from mercury are dependent upon how much mercury a person has inhaled. With smaller exposures, there can be damage to the lungs, the nervous system, and the kidneys. And if exposed for a long period,
they could still have some of the same issues, but there'll be more, nervous system. You may find some, tremors and people having emotional disturbances. They could have kidney damage, blood pressure issues, and some people may just not be experiencing any of that, but if they do, we're interested in following up with them.
Hamade says 80% of mercury inhaled is absorbed by the body. Some exits the body through urine, so the team of health officials will simply be taking urine samples next week. The samples will be sent to be analyzed in Atlanta, and Hamade says they hope to get results a month later. Reporting in Nome, I'm Lorelei Kinneen.
The Fairbanks North Star Borough would take on utility powers and build a natural gas distribution network under a proposal being pushed by a group of local leaders. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Two separate private sector plans are already in the works to truck natural gas to Fairbanks, but things aren't happening fast enough for some Fairbanks leaders, including Borough Assembly member Nadine Winters. Winters wants the borough to take on the responsibility of jumpstarting things by building a $400 to $600 million local gas distribution network.
It's a costly thing given our population densities, and so I would argue that there's a public need and there would be a huge public benefit from dollars going into a distribution system. I don't think it's going to technically pencil out for anyone else.
A recently released state-funded study found huge consumer energy savings and improved air quality if gas can get to more Fairbanks consumers. Fairbanks Natural Gas and a partnership of Golden Valley Electric and Flint Hills Refinery are working separately to truck North Slope natural gas to town. Fairbanks Natural Gas currently supplies 1,100 customers in the city with gas from Cook Inlet. CEO Dan Britton says there's no need for the borough to get involved in gas distribution.
I don't see any value in that. First of all, they don't have any response to the supply question. Without supply, the distribution system is of little to no value.
Britton acknowledges there are some rural areas of the borough where a distribution system won't pay for itself, and that's where government support may be necessary. The Fairbanks and North Pole City Councils are considering turning over their utility authority to the North Star Borough, a first step before the Assembly can look at an ordinance creating a natural gas utility. The group pushing the proposal also includes Borough Mayor Luke Hopkins, former Attorney General John Burns, and FEDCO head Jim Dodson. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
A preliminary report on an August 7th fatal helicopter crash at a remote site near the Pogo gold mine states that a log that was dislodged from the helipad may have played a role in the accident. The National Transportation Safety Board's report states that a witness told investigators that he heard the crash and was running to the site when he noticed that a log was jutting upward on one side of the helipad. The pad in use at the site was built of horizontal interlocking logs nailed together with long spikes. It's a commonly used design for helipads in remote locations. NTSB senior investigator Clint Johnson said this afternoon that fellow investigators are looking into the witness's statement and haven't ruled it out as a possible cause of the crash.
One of the witnesses that was on his way to the scene immediately after the accident indicated that one of the logs was displaced and indicated that it wasn't displaced before the machine landed. So we are definitely looking to see if by chance that was part of the accident or played a part in the accident. But again, things are in the preliminary stages of the accident investigation.
Johnson says investigators have theorized one of the helicopter skids may have come into contact with the log and dislodged it.
We're trying to rule that out at this point. At this point, it is not ruled out that it may very well have played a part in the accident. But again, we are in the preliminary stages, and everything is subject to change.
The report states that another eyewitness told an NTSB investigator that he saw the helicopter set down on a remote helipad at about 4:30 August 7th. The witness says he had radioed the pilot to request a pickup and was kneeling beside the pad, watching for the pilot to give the signal to board. He said the helicopter suddenly pitched up, then backward, before striking trees nearby and rolling down a steep slope. The crash killed 63-year-old James Hopper, a Missouri resident who was flying the helicopter for Aurora Aviation Services. The Delta Junction-based company was contracted by Pogo to ferry personnel and supplies to the site that was being explored for gold mining potential. Pogo is located in an isolated area about 38 miles northeast of Delta. Johnson says NTSB investigators expect to return to the site on September 1st. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the village of Akutan gets hovercraft service to reach their new airstrip.
They're not going to build a bridge, and there's really no way to get a conventional vessel to serve the route back and forth.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. Check the status of your permanent fund dividend application at pfd.alaska.gov. August 31st is the deadline for contributing to a college savings plan and to add or change charitable donations. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Former State Representative Harry Crawford is running for State Senate in District M against Senator Betty Davis, who has served for more than a decade. Crawford says he better represents the new District M, which was reformed during redistricting, and he's going door to door in hopes of winning the seat in Tuesday's primary election. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has more.
Most nights, Harry Crawford can be found walking around East Anchorage with a handful of campaign pamphlets and a friendly smile.
Going door to door for the evening.
Tonight, he's going door to door in his own neighborhood, Chugach Foothills, where voters recognize him.
Hi there. I'm making the rounds, introducing myself and reintroducing myself to people that know me well.
Come on in if you'd like.
Back at his modest split-level home, Crawford has turned his dining room table into a central command for his campaign for Senator for District M. On the wall beside his dinner table is a framed print of John F. Kennedy in a sailing skiff. It features a quote.
One man can make a difference, and every man should try.
A motto Crawford says he lives by. A retired iron worker, Crawford drove up the Alcan Highway in 1975 from his hometown of Shreveport, Louisiana, to work on the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. He first tried to make a difference in politics, he says, when he ran for state representative in his district in 1996 against then-Speaker of the House Ramona Barnes. It took him three campaigns to unseat her in 2000, and he's remained in politics since. After serving as a state representative, he ran against Congressman Don Young in 2010, but lost. Now he's running against Senator Bette Davis. Crawford says if he's elected, one of his priorities will be forward funding for Anchorage schools.
There's no good reason to hand people out pink slips in the spring and then rehire them in the summer. If we're going to fund them anyway, let's fund them right through so that they are not worried about losing their job.
Crawford says he'll also push to increase the base student allocation. On lowering taxes on oil companies, Crawford says taxes are not the issue.
What we have to do is get a gas pipeline so that we can sell our products around the Pacific Rim. I think that the key to more oil production and a better life for Alaskans is to get an all-Alaska gas line to Tidewater so that we can market our gas, plus have a ready supply of gas for people in South Central Alaska and the interior.
On affordable housing, Crawford says it's something the market will solve.
There's never been a better time since I've been in construction to actually build something because the interest rates are so low. If the banks are ready to loan, if they actually are, then I'm sure if there's a market for more rental housing and more single families, they'll be built.
As far as healthcare goes, Crawford says we should do something like his home state does.
I'm originally from Louisiana. It's about the cheapest healthcare in the whole country. Yet they have some of the better outcomes for their healthcare in the whole country. And the reason why is because they have a very large state-run health system through the LSU School of Medicine. Big teaching hospitals, they're much cheaper. Ours is the most expensive healthcare in the country. Louisiana's is the cheapest. Yet I don't think there's a dime's worth of difference in the care.
Crawford says he'll push for a medical school and a teaching hospital in Alaska, but the most important thing, he believes, is job creation, which he sees as intrinsically linked to a gas pipeline. Crawford will appear on the primary ballot running against fellow Democrat Bette Davis on August 28th. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
The state has finalized its approval of a Petersburg borough plan. In a teleconference meeting this morning, Alaska's Local Boundary Commission, or LBC, passed its written decision on the matter. Commission staffer Brent Williams says he expects to put the document in the mail by tomorrow.
The mail out will start the reconsideration period, which is 18 days for the public from the date of mailing, and it is 30 days for the commission. That information is in the decision, and as a courtesy, the parties will also email it to them so they get it as quickly as possible.
Petersburg's proposed borough government would expand municipal boundaries and taxing authority over a much larger area. The new borough would include the cities of Petersburg and Kuprianov, Mitkov, and Wadoski Islands, a large portion of Kuprianov Island and the mainland from Lakonti Bay to Holcomb Bay. The city and borough of Juneau filed a competing petition seeking to annex some of the same mainland territory. Juneau's annexation petition is still before the LBC. The commission could vote on it in January. Once the LBC mails out its decision, the state's Division of Elections will conduct the local vote on whether or not to incorporate the new borough. That could happen late this fall or winter. Two Republicans with ties to the Matanuska-Susitna Borough School Board are vying for the Senate D candidate slot in next week's primary. While both see education funding as a priority, the two have distinct views on the state's fiscal policies. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
The Senate District D primary race pits incumbent Senator Linda Menard against Matsu School Board President Mike Dunleavy. Menard once had the post Dunleavy now holds, so it's no surprise that education funding concerns both campaigns, and although both claim conservative values, that's where the similarity ends. Dunleavy, a former Northwest Arctic Borough school superintendent, says he'll do a better job than Senator Menard when it comes to dealing with state fiscal issues.
Our state funding relies heavily on the flow of oil, which we know is diminishing steadily. This must be addressed. We have little choice. With approximately 90% of Alaska's funding derived from oil, this needs to be the priority in the next legislative session. Unfortunately, key legislation that would have dealt with increasing the flow of oil in the pipeline, as well as construction of a natural gas pipeline, has been stalled in the Senate. In order to solve this issue, the makeup of the Senate must be changed.
Dunleavy takes a strong Republican Party stance and attacks Menard's association with the Senate's bipartisan working group, blaming the Senate coalition for the failure to entice more oil production to Alaska by blocking Governor Parnell's oil tax bill. Dunleavy says Alaska is, quote, on the freight train to Brokeville, unquote, a catchy phrase, but why is he saying it?
To the current operating budget is unsustainable, especially given the diminishing oil flow in the pipeline. The discussion is going to morph from more oil to the budget over the next legislative session, and this is something we're going to have to tackle. Budget's going north, spending's going north, revenues are going south, and we're in trouble.
Linda Menard has the endorsement of the NRA, the support of NEA leaders, and the MATSU Educators PAC. She also has a long history on the MATSU school board, 12 years, in fact. And she has 4 years in the legislature and stands by the Senate bipartisan working group.
Every time you have an election, there's no magic wand or no magic ball to say what's going to be the result. So you look at people, we're all good Alaskans, so let's build on that. Let's figure out what we can do in commons. Try to get a very good balanced budget. And our area is the fastest growing area in the state. And certainly, I don't want to not play a role in trying to bring the infrastructure that's so badly needed, roads, bridges, the airports, we need this, and I have to play a part and bring capital projects back, and I can't do it sitting in the corner.
Menard, who challenged incumbent Senator Lyda Green in the 2008 primary, won that race unchallenged when Green decided against running for another term. Menard places fiscal responsibility with budget negotiations.
The governor comes out with his budget first. He was very pleased that we stayed within his parameters of the capital budget. So it's a process where he does his budget first, and then we look at what we can do in the, as far as the capital budget and the Senate part, and then we pass it down to the House while they're working on the operating budget. So I feel that's a good process.
Menard says she's proud of bringing home appropriations to the Valley. During her term, the MATSU School District received more funds than any other district in the state. In regard to education funding, Dunleavy says state spending should be flexible and include homeschools, charter schools, vouchers.
I believe that various methods and innovative ways of educating a student will only enhance education, including public education. I've been a supporter of public education my entire career. That's my job. That's my profession.
He says it's not certain where education cuts could be made.
I would cut programs that are not necessarily mandated by the Constitution. I would cut programs that, I wouldn't be given $4 million to the University of Alaska to help with the shootout. There's a number of things, but I'd have to look into the budget to see exactly what we would cut.
Menard says the MATSU Borough School District already offers wide choices.
From charter schools to career tech schools, and we do give vouchers out to people who do homeschooling so they can go and do some extracurricular stuff. So again, that is something that I take very seriously.
Menard has raised more than $48,000 for her campaign, where Dunleavy's disclosures show more than $60,000. About $12,000 of that comes from the candidate himself or family members. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
The hovercraft that will link the village of Accutan with its new airport made the trip down from Cold Bay last week. The hovercraft has a long and storied history operating in the Aleutians, but it's the only connection between the new runway and the community of 1,000 people. KUCB's Stephanie Joyce has the story.
The Aleutians Eastboro acquired the Suna X in 2007 to provide a transportation link between King Cove and the all-weather airport in Cold Bay. The hovercraft operated on and off for a little over 2 years until 2010, when the borough permanently suspended its operations. They cited high costs, mechanical problems, and unreliability. It's been sitting in King Cove ever since, but now the borough is giving it a second chance in Accutan.
They're not going to build a bridge, and there's really no way to get a conventional vessel to serve the route back and forth. Hovercraft were deemed to be the only option many years ago when the studies were done, and we're there to provide that service.
Marty Robbins is the general manager of Hoverlink, the Seattle company that will be operating the hovercraft. He says the vessel just had a $1.4 million overhaul and that it's ready to go when the airport opens.
We'll coordinate with the airlines and on schedule trips and any charters that are arranged, and we'll be there weather permitting for every flight that arrives or departs.
Weather permitting. Robin says the hovercraft can operate in up to 6-foot seas and 40-knot winds. Based on analysis of historical data, he calculates that means it should be able to operate 90% of the time.
Time will tell, but we know that a hovercraft has got a better chance on that particular body of water than most other conventional vessels and boats.
The service won't come cheap, though. Robbins estimates operational costs at $200,000 a month, or $2.4 million a year. For a borough with a budget of $6 million, that's a lot of money. And Borough Administrator Rick Gifford says the details of how it's going to be paid for are still being worked out. He's discussing a fee schedule with Trident Seafoods, the community's largest employer, but he wouldn't talk about it because it hasn't been finalized. However, if it's similar to what was in place on the King Cove Cold Bay route, annual ticket sales will total less than $200,000, or a single month's operating costs. But Gifford is confident that it will all work out. It has to work out, because otherwise there'll be a $77 million airport that no one can access. Marty Robbins from Hoverlink.
It's going to be shame on a lot of people if the amount of money that has been invested out there is deemed to be wasteful at some point. You know, that's what we have to avoid, and we have to make it work and be a success.
The airport will have a soft opening on September 1st to test how everything works. An official opening date hasn't been announced. In Unalaska, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
A popular Fairbanks area hiking trail recently closed due to bear trouble has reopened. The Granite Tours Trail in the Chena River State Recreation Area has been the location of 4 human bear encounters this summer, the latest of which saw a bear tear a hole in a camper's tent. No one has been hurt, but bear spray, rocks, and gunshots have been used to scare the animals off. Park Ranger Nikki Potter says a week-long closure that ended Monday gave rangers a chance to assess the situation.
We hiked the trail several times and have not seen any bear. There has been some bear sign on the trail, so the public is advised to use bear safety.
3 of this summer's bear encounters involved a pair of young grizzly cubs, while the 4th involved a black bear. The trouble is suspected to be the result of the animals finding human food and trash along the trail and an abundant area berry crop. Potter says the approach of fall and end of berry season should see bears move off to other areas. A handful of organizations have teamed up to create a unique way of assessing the health of the world's oceans. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
Earlier this month, the Ocean Health Index was unveiled. It's the work of a team of experts, including Andy Rosenberg. He's the director of the Center for Science and Democracy at the Union of Concerned Scientists.
Our goal was to develop a concise, understandable, like transparent, in other words, you could understand right through from top to bottom, index that would give us a measure of whether things in the ocean were getting better or worse and what some of the key attributes that humans depend upon, how they were doing, comparing region to region, country to country, and over time.
The Ocean Health Index is broken out with 10 specific index points that cover things like fishing, clean water, biodiversity, and coastal protection. Rosenberg says the index was put together using global data sets with the goal of expanding the index to include additional data collected locally.
We wanted to set that as our initial benchmark. And the idea now is to improve the data with a lot of that local information and to refine the index in places where there's better data, Alaska being a great example. We really could refine the index estimates using the calculation methods that we've developed specifically for the Gulf of Alaska or the Bering Sea or the Chukchi Sea, for that matter, or the Arctic, and then use that as a long-term measure because we know that there's better data than might be contained in some of these so-called global data sets that is available locally. The reason we didn't do that now is because if we did that, we couldn't compare Alaska to China, to Japan, to Mexico, or any other place around the world, so we needed a globally consistent set of data.
The Ocean Health Index was unveiled on August 15th, and the total average global score was 60, based on a scale of 1 to 100, with 100 being the best index number available. The average score for the United States was 63. Rosenberg says a number in the low 60s should be concerning, but he says there are simple things that can be done to improve the overall health of the oceans.
In some cases, you can identify in individual countries relatively simple things that can be done that could be important improvements in the score. So, for example, on clean water, you might think, oh, well, you know, but it's incredibly expensive to develop, you know, sophisticated water treatment plants and so on. But in fact, cleaning up trash on the beaches is one of the most important things that you can do in many parts of the world.
One of the lowest index numbers included in the larger Ocean Health Index is the food provision category, which represents both wild seafood and aquaculture. The global index number is 24. The index number for the United States is 25. Rosenberg explains.
For food provisioning, because it's both aquaculture and wild-caught fisheries, it is a combined score. If you just looked at the capture fisheries, the U.S. would be doing better because there's a very strong governance system in place. But parts of the country, including where I sit in New England, still have a long way to go in terms of recovering fisheries. You know, that's true to various degrees all around the country, and it's a national score as opposed to a score for Alaska.
The scientists that developed the Ocean Health Index note that 84% of all monitored marine stocks are characterized as fully exploited, overexploited, or depleted, and they claim that the capacity of the world's fishing fleets is now 2.5 times levels they call sustainable. The Ocean Health Index was officially unveiled in this month's edition of the journal Nature. You can take a look at the index online at oceanhealthindex.org. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Lorelei Kanin in Nome, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Tim Ellis in Delta, Ellen Lockyer and Dacia Eaton in Anchorage, Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, Stephanie Joyce in Unalaska, and Mike Mason in Dillingham. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
A recent statewide survey by Dittman Research showed that 65% of Alaskans think it's time to build the Kinnick Arm Crossing, and 77% of those surveyed believe the bridge will save Alaskans time, money, and provide our economy with needed jobs. For facts on the Kinnick Arm Bridge, visit KinnickArmBridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority. Fall semester is just around the corner. Alaska Pacific University offers two-year, four-year, master and doctorate level programs committed to student-centered experiential learning. And there's no application deadline. Online education options are available in all undergraduate programs. For more information on how to obtain a quality and affordable education, visit alaskapacific.edu or call 564-8248. This message sponsored by APU.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.